You and I, all of us, back together again on Friday, December 3rd, 2021, for another edition of Connecticut Today. We welcome back Yankee Institute for Public Policy reporter Mark Fitch to chat about growing tension between Governor Ned Lamont and state employee union officials, as well as some questions being raised now about Connecticut First Lady Annie Lamont's business dealings. Dr. Anthony Santella from the University of New Haven made a return visit to talk about the latest developments regarding the COVID-19 Omicron variant. Back for his monthly check-in on all things state government, keeping an eye on stuff, Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check out his Fitch files at yankeeinstitute.org. And Mark is here. Hey, Mark, it's Paul. How are you, sir?
Hey, Paul. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you.
Great that you could spend the time with us, Mark. We appreciate the regular check-ins. Couple things. Let's talk first about what I guess we were waiting for, Mark. It didn't happen right away as soon as we thought, but I guess now I'm reading where the tension is rising a little bit. It's not crazy yet, between Governor Ned Lamont and the state employee unions, because there is a big wave of retirements coming up, and the unions are telling the governor, hey, don't go thinking of any mass job eliminations here. We expect you to refill the majority of these positions. What's going on with that?
Well, I mean, that is precisely what's happening. It's part of a larger friction that has been happening between the Lamont administration and the unions, going back to a number of issues. They're still trying to, finalize the, teleworking, the working from home deal with the unions. So there's that. Obviously, they want, raises put into the budget and things of that nature. But their biggest concern is this retirement cliff that's coming in 2022, where, upwards of 8,000 state employees might retire. They don't know how many will, but it's up there, and that could leave a huge hole in services that the state can provide. And Lamont, for to his credit, has been trying to explore different ways in which the state could streamline government services so they need fewer people and can substitute that personnel with technology. It was part of a study that he contracted with the Boston Consulting Group to figure out where can we save money when these people start retiring. The unions were having none of it. They didn't want their members to even respond to the surveys that were sent out by Boston Consulting Group. Their biggest thing is they want, everybody replaced. They say that, state government has essentially been shrinking the size of its workforce over the past 10 or 12 years. And, obviously, they want more people in there because that kind of keeps the dues flowing. But, to kind of throw them a bone here, there is going to be, if that many people do retire, there is going to be some holes that'll have to be filled. I don't think you'd be able to make up that big a gap with, just changing, technologies and new software and things like that. So the state will have to do some hiring. And I know, even in response to this infrastructure package that's coming down, I know the Department of Transportation is looking to hire several hundred people to try to be able to spend this money and figure out what to do with it, to get these projects off the ground. But this has all been simmering for a while. And there's been, some rallies and, protests and calling for fair contracts and things like that. An ongoing negotiation. I mean, right now the administration is currently in negotiations for the next collective bargaining agreements with all these public sector unions. Mm-hmm. So this all just feeds into it. It's, how much are we getting paid? What are our benefits going to be? And you better start hiring more people. And the Lamont administration is, I'd say, doing a fairly good job, and this is all outside the box. It seems like they're doing a fairly good job of saying, well, we want to try to streamline government. We think we can do it.
Mark, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Mark Fitch is with us. Monthly check-in from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Get more into the weeds here as to Connecticut's budget, hiring or not to hire. First, though, traffic and weather together at 3:36 on Connecticut Today. All right, back to open phones momentarily. We're at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM. We continue with Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check him out, yankeeinstitute.org. And, Mark, before we get to the dealings with the governor and the First Lady, Annie Lamont, and some of their financial holdings, all the controversy around that, you know, we just had a call off air. A nice gentleman called in and said, geez, you know, interesting conversation, but, you know, Mark Fitch sounds a little like he's anti-union here. Mark, I just want to give you the chance to respond here. Are you anti-union, or are you just laying out the facts of what's going on?
Well, I mean, this is what's going on. I'm not anti-union. I'm anti-union running the state. You know, that's the difference, is who's actually controlling the reins of power. And a lot of times it seems that the unions have that power. You know, they obviously put a lot of money into getting Governor Ned Lamont elected, just like they put money into getting Governor Malloy elected. And this is the person that they negotiate with for these contracts. And those contracts have a lot of provisions in them that cause, you know, that dictate how the state of Connecticut can do business and dictate what can be cut and when it can be cut. So, you know, this involves a lot of money. It involves a lot of regulations and powers and things like that. So, you know, it's not necessarily anti-union. It's what are the taxpayers getting for this? Mm-hmm. I mean, who's really, you know, controlling the strings of power here?
Yeah, and Mark, speaking of controlling the strings, before we go to the whole Andy Lamont thing, one last thing on these negotiations. I mean, look, the governor is not going to be dumb enough, right? You and I both know this. He's an incredibly bright guy. You don't get to be worth that much money if you're not. But he's not going to propose so many cuts that it's going to put the physical welfare of some people in Connecticut in jeopardy. He doesn't want to cut back spending money so people die. But, you know, again, Mark, I think this is what happens when you get a guy from the private sector as a governor who comes in. You're right, and he keeps talking about streamlining, stronger, faster, cheaper. How do we get it done? I mean, that's right out of the boardroom of some of his Fairfield County friends.
Oh, that's very true. And obviously in Connecticut, we're a little behind the times when it comes to updating technology in state government. And, you know, a lot of these things are still done on paper at Connecticut departments. And, you know, there are ways to streamline. There are ways to modernize. And it doesn't necessarily mean putting people in danger. And it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, mass layoffs or, you know, attrition of state employee numbers to the point where it puts anything in jeopardy. But I think there can be a happy medium that can be reached. And, you know, maybe not everybody needs to be replaced person by person. I mean, but we have, you know, technology is out there. There can be some upgrades that the state can do. And, you know, moving forward, you know, we've seen this in action. You know, the Department of Labor during the COVID pandemic, mm-hmm. they were overwhelmed with unemployment claims and needed to implement some new software in order to manage all that because they didn't have the manpower, but they were able to get some technology in there to make the process easier and get these people the money that they needed during their time laid off.
Sure. The situation with the governor and the First Lady of the state, Annie Lamont, and one of the companies she was involved with, Mark, and now the governor and saying, hey, my wife and I, we divested ourselves of these companies before COVID kicked in. You know, in the couple of minutes that we have left here for people who may be looking at this and their eyes are glazing over, what are the essential questions here that the governor and his wife are coming under scrutiny for, not just from political opponents, but even some editorialists around the state are saying, hey, are you being upfront here?
Yeah, and I think it's really a matter of disclosure and transparency. Nothing that the governor has done, and clearly nothing that his wife has done, have violated any of the state ethics rules yet that we know of. At this point, it's not an ethical or legal question as much as it is a political question, and it's becoming a political headache for Governor Lamont. The SEMA 4 contract, which, you know, it was a COVID testing contract for a company that the governor's wife had invested in, they they still had that investment. They just said they were going to give the give whatever profits there may be to charity.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as we know, there have been no profits yet. With the other company, this digital currency group, they did divest on from that about 6 months before the announcement that the company was coming here. But that SEMA 4 contract was kind of in the air. You know, the Connecticut Mirror had just done a big story about it. And obviously, Bob Stefanowski had brought it up in op-eds. And so with that hanging in the air, then you have this other connection to the Lamont's investment firm. And it just kind of it clouds the water, and it makes for some political difficulties for the governor. And I think what the real question everybody has is, well, you know, is the governor's position being used to somehow advance his own personal wealth mm-hmm. or the wealth of his wife's company? So far, you know, it's pretty impossible to tell, but that question lingers, and it's a difficult one to address for the governor.
And Ned Lamont doesn't seem, at least to me, and I've only talked to him once or twice, Mark, he doesn't seem to me anyway, and I could be wrong, but he doesn't seem to me to be a guy that would do something dumb like that to put himself in a precarious position. I could be wrong, but I don't think he gives off that vibe. I don't know.
Well, I think this is just kind of a confluence of factors. When you have a business person such as Lamont, you know, come into office, and he has all these business connections, you know. And not only that, but, you know, his wife, who runs a very successful, you know, venture capital firm, has connections to, I think, thousands of companies.
Of course.
And, yeah, there's a lot of little lines that can be drawn there. But, you know, at this point, it does raise a lot of political problems for the governor, and it raises a lot of questions that can be thrown at him. And he seems like he's getting a little annoyed with it, I guess, understandably, but how you handle those questions can really, you know, determine how the public receives you and views you. So it's the governor should probably work on getting his messaging straight on that, because it's clearly going to be an issue in the upcoming election.
Yeah, maybe, Mark, you know, just a news conference where he comes out and says, okay, let's talk about this from soup to nuts, and let me lay out the facts. PowerPoints, Mark, you know, those are always good. Let's do a PowerPoint.
A little slide presentation,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. My investments, Annie's investments, and everything's fine. Mark Fitch, great stuff as always, dumbing it down for a host like me. I appreciate it. Check out his stuff, folks. Mark Fitch, YankeeInstitute.org. Mark, if I don't speak to you, happy holidays, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Same to you. Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. Mark Fitch there of the Yankee Institute. Yeah, that's what it sounds like, folks. You know, unless Mr. Stefanowski or Ms. Claritas or whoever's going to run on the Republican ticket, you know, unless they can draw a significant quid pro quo, this for that, pay to play between Annie Lamont's investment firm and that SEMA 4 company with the COVID testing. That, I think for most people, it's going to be a non-issue. For most people, maybe for others, could be different. We have had this gentleman on the show before, at least once during the COVID-19 pandemic. We welcome Dr. Anthony Santella. He's a professor of health administration and policy and directs the Doctorate of Health Sciences program for the School of Health Sciences at the University of New Haven, high on the hill in West Haven. He's also the school's COVID-19 coordinator. Dr. Santella, it's Paul here again at WICC. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me. Good to speak with you again.
Yeah, good to have you on. I wanted to have you back on because, you know, we're kind of in this new chapter now, Dr. Santella, which I guess the health professionals like yourselves and all the doctors that I've interviewed say the whole occurrence of a new variant or variants, I mean, this is kind of expected, correct?
Yeah, I mean, this is what viruses do to survive, right? There's virus spreading in the community. And so what they want to do to be competitive and survive and thrive is to mutate, to change, and continue spreading. And given that we have what I'd say probably, you know, mediocre vaccination rates, means that the virus continues to spread, People are getting exposed. The virus is doing its thing. And until we increase our vaccination rates, we're going to continue to see this, Omicron, Delta. These won't be the last of the variants.
Did I read correctly, Dr. Santella, that there is a theory in immunology and virology that as some of these variants pop up, not just with COVID-19, but other viruses, they tend to infect a little less. They may be transmissible, but they might not be as strong as the original, original one. Did I read that correctly?
Yes. So there you go with your public health and scientific hat on. I love when I hear people digging into the science like that. Thank you. The basic and bench scientists and clinicians are really still figuring these big questions out. But what we know so far and what's been made clear through the cooperation of both the South African and American scientists and others is that, this probably will spread a little more quickly. But what we see right now are much more mild cases. So in some respects, you almost want it to become more prevalent than something like Delta, which continues to cause hospitalizations and unfortunately deaths. So that's kind of an odd way of looking at it. But yes, right now, more mild cases, we're not seeing huge increases in hospitalizations, which represents, moderate severe deaths. And so while we certainly don't want anyone to contract COVID, at this point, we know it's here to stay for a while.
Dr. Santella, I see in your background, and we talked about this previously, too, one of your areas of study is HIV and AIDS. And I'm reading here, I believe, in the past couple of days that there's a thought here that there's may have been, and they're very cautious in saying this, is that the original origins of COVID or maybe some of the variants would be some sort of a viral collision between a coronavirus and HIV and AIDS. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, hard to tell. The coronavirus has been here for a while. I mean, the family of coronaviruses have been around in animals since the 50s and people since the 60s. So this is the one that's unfortunately had substantive impact on human health. But the true origins still remain a bit of a question mark. And, leading scientists like Dr. Fauci and others really have reminded us that we need to not forget that we need to investigate really its true origins. Is it something that perhaps came from a laboratory? Is it something like you mentioned, viruses kind of integrating in society and, doing their thing? And this is just the first time we've had such an impact on human health. And I hope that when the dust settles, which, we will get there sooner than later, that we allow scientists really to have the space that they need to, further investigate this using the scientific process, because, it's not a matter of if this will happen again, but when.
I had a couple of recent callers, Doctor, and we're speaking with Dr. Anthony Santella from the University of New Haven in the public health sector there. I had a couple of recent callers, Dr. Santella, that said, I took my first shot, I took my second shot, now they're telling me I need a booster, I may need more than one booster. And I try to tell them, Doctor, and I think you may agree with me here, that I think people sometimes, Doctor, lose focus here is they're treating diseases and viruses. It's not like setting a broken bone. It's not like doing a heart operation or a shoulder replacement or a knee replacement. Things really can change in a matter of just a few days, can't they?
Certainly. And that's unfortunately what we see, right? It's, this is something that's evolving on a weekly, daily, sometimes hourly basis. And I get it, right? Most people out there aren't trained in public health and science, and this seems confusing, contradictory. It questions the role of science in public health and society. But these are how these things work. And as public health professionals, this is what we study, right? Disease outbreak investigation, best practice, using evidence and science to guide our policies and programs. And so this is what we do. And, America's getting a lesson in public health, which may be one of the few silver linings of this pandemic. It's one of those things where getting a booster is important. We know that the eligibility has slightly shifted over time. Again, that's not because it was wrong or contradictory. It's because the pandemic has evolved and changed. And so we need to be able to adapt in real time and make sure that the American public understands why those changes are happening. And so, yes, most people got, you know, two doses of Pfizer, Moderna, or one dose of J&J and thought, you know, okay, I did my part, I'm good. But now we know that virus is continuing to mutate, it's forming variants, and that immunity that you got from your initial vaccination wanes over time. And so we need to get a boost for that. And that's what the booster does. And this may not be the last booster. Who knows? I mean, the question still remains, will this be something where just like a flu shot, as the flu mutates and changes every year, you get a new flu shot, mm-hmm. you know, to accommodate those different strains? Or is it something that you get every few years? Maybe this is a one and done after we get through these next, you know, this year and next year. That remains to be studied. But, you know, err on the side of caution, continue using those public health mitigation strategies that we know have worked for decades and decades and decades, like the mask wearing, proper hand hygiene, not being around a lot of people at once, getting vaccinated or your booster if you're eligible, getting tested, seeking your guidance from your primary care provider if you're not feeling well. All those things have gotten us through very tough times and difficult situations globally, and it will get us through our current situation as well.
Dr. Anthony Santella, professor of health administration and policy, directs the Doctorate of Health Sciences program for the School of Health and Sciences at the University of New Haven. Doctor, good to speak with you again. Take care. Happy holidays, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tim.
Appreciate it. There you go.